This is what should be done by one who is skilled in goodness and who knows the path of peace. Let them be able and upright, straightforward and gentle in speech, humble and not conceited, contented and easily satisfied, unburdened with duties, and frugal in their ways, peaceful and calm and wise and skillful, not proud and demanding in nature. Let them not do the slightest thing that the wise would later reprove, wishing in gladness and in safety. May all beings be at ease. Whatever living beings there may be, whether they are weak or strong, omitting none, the great or the mighty, medium, short or small, the seen and the unseen, those living near and far away, those born and to be born, may all beings be at ease. Let none deceive another or despise any being in any state. Let none through anger or ill will wish harm upon another. Even as a mother protects with her life her child, her only child, so with a boundless heart should one cherish all living beings, radiating kindness over the entire world, spreading upwards to the skies and downwards to the depths, outwards and unbounded, freed from hatred and ill will, whether standing or walking, seated or lying down, freed from drowsiness, one should sustain this recollection. This is said to be the sublime abiding. By not holding to fixed views, the pure-hearted one, having clarity of vision, being freed from all sense desires, is not born again into this world.
Well, over to you, Venerable. It's all yours.
Oh, thank you. So, with the meditation, because this is a meditation group, so this gives us great opportunity to talk about it. But also because we're heading towards the rain, so I'm lucky enough to have the second last shot. Ajahn Brahm will be taking the next video, I understand. So this is the second last one before the rains. It's a big opportunity. And one of the things that is interesting is the shift in thought and practice for lay people at home in meditation from the early Buddhist ideal up until today. And it's quite a big shift. It's kind of remarkable. But also the interpretation for formal practice as well, whether in a retreat center or in a monastery or just taking a weekend at home and really dedicating yourself to some good quality time on the cushion or on your chair. And this is very, very interesting, because when we look at those early ideals and those early methods, and we take into account the shift, we can see we've actually lost a lot of value. We've lost a lot of very useful skills and techniques, we could say, that are so important. One of the interesting things is, of course, we hear about, sometimes as a criticism, you could say, that for lay people practice, you know, you just have to keep the five precepts and, you know, maybe turn up at the monastery and feed the monks, and that's all you have to do. And it's basically as if lay people don't exist, which is a bit unfortunate. And that has made a huge shift in how Buddhism has been presented, but also a huge shift in what's available for people at home. Because everybody is trying to do their best and be good meditators and really develop the practice. And yet, the amount of information available isn't really that great. And it's really unfortunate. So one of the big things, of course, is we hear the starting of generosity and sila, virtue, or good habits, basically. The word literally means habit. And what's important in there is the foundation. We talked last time about how it is the thought that counts, that brings it all together and makes it so wonderful. And we bring that into the meditation practice because that helps us to develop a steady foundation as well as a steady relationship with ourselves. Because the mind is very, very complicated. Lots of different things happening at once. Lots of different things all cooked together to make it work. One of my favorite references that I use again and again and again is a reference of a soup pot. And you just add the tiniest little ingredient to that soup pot and it changes the entire pot. And that's really very useful to understand. It's just small little things really change the entire thing. So injecting a bit more loving kindness into our life and a bit more compassion and a bit more joy and a bit more happiness into our life. But as well as appreciating the good things we do and the good things we have done and the good things that other people do really also helps bolster the practice because there's so many little avenues to enrich what we're doing. And that's so important because when we're sitting down on a meditation cushion or our chair or lying down, a lot of the times it's like we're wandering into enemy territory kind of thing. It's like we're this... or into, foreign territory, you could say, is that we're trying to navigate and we're sort of looking around and not quite sure what to do and it just all happens around us and unfortunately we can't keep track of it. Whereas, when you have a good foundation, things are a lot more steady. Things are a lot more easy to deal with. And you have that closeness of a relationship with yourself, which you've developed through just simple things. Unfortunately, a lot of the times, the presentation of virtuous deeds and good karma and all that stuff is presented as something really sort of high level, like you have to donate squillions of dollars or, you know, do Herculean kinds of challenges to do that, when it's not really so. It's something very, very basic. It's something very, very everyday. And because it's so everyday, it slips past us and we don't really know. And it's just not taught to people. This world and this life is full of small joys, and yet we miss them all because we're so often looking for this bigger joy, or we just don't even know to look for them, which is very, very unfortunate. But once you know they're there, you find they're everywhere. Whether it's seeing a beautiful sunrise or sunset, or walking through a nice garden, or enjoying family time, or doing quality time with friends, or quality time with yourself. All worthwhile. That enriches your life so much. And this is the stuff that collectively, so easy to build up. And there's this practice called Chaganusati, the recollection of the good and the generosity we've done. And for most of us, all of us really, there's so much good that we have done. And yet we don't take it into account. You know, we just think, oh yeah, it just happened yesterday or something else. And we're so busy, there's so many demands, we're so stimulated as well. So much going on in the world and so much we need to understand. The tragedies happening in Europe, the problems happening around the world. And unfortunately, it's so hard to find or even to feel valid to feel that happiness. It kind of seems trivial. But unfortunately, if we do that, we do sell ourselves out, which is very unfortunate. And it's not something that we have to do. We can keep those to solidify ourselves, so to speak, you know, so we're more robust and resilient against, you know, all the challenges we face in life. And that's also where the meditation comes in, because these things, they're really all linked together. We put out these terms, sila, samadhi, panya. So the good habits, the meditation, the stillness, and the wisdom. But really, they're all connected, and they build off each other. So with wisdom, you develop good habits. With good habits, you improve your meditation. With your meditation, you improve your wisdom, and they bounce off each other. And with improving your wisdom, you improve your meditation as well. So it's not just circular, it's all kinds of all over the place. And that is so useful to know because it's so empowering. It gives it back to you that you can do this. And this is so wonderful. You can do it at home, no problem. Because this mind is so complicated, there's so many things going round and round and round. We have so many vested interests, so many conflicts of interest, so many needs and concerns and fears and hopes and dreams and agendas and all these things going on. But there's also this significant part of us, deep down, that can't manage, that looks at the world and all this chaos, and looks inside us and looks at how resilient we are, how skillful we are in relation to that. And it basically says, no way, we're not doing this. Shut down. And it blocks all this out because we can't deal with it. It's a coping strategy. And that makes an insurmountable barrier to developing good meditation and to developing our good, you know, our good life. Because it locks us down. It shuts things out. It prevents us from moving forward because it has fear. It's not confident. It doesn't feel that we can do this. And sometimes it needs a boost from someone to say that you can do this. And to attend classes like the Armidale Meditation Group or other sites on YouTube or visiting a local retreat center and going for it. Exploring this new territory, improving that relationship with yourself. And that's so rewarding. Because once we start to deal with this part of ourselves that can't cope, that sort of is afraid of this big complex world, and it feels more confident how we can deal with things, it starts to trust us more. It can loosen its barriers. You know, we talked about firewalls before. This is the same thing. Our coping strategies put up massive firewalls to protect ourselves. But in doing so, we build a fortress. And fortresses, they're great. They're very defensive, well-designed, they do their job. But they're prisons to live in, really. So there's times that we need to recognize that we don't need to live in our fortress. We can open up more. But here's an unfortunate problem with meditation and how it's often taught. And I have brought along a little prop because to talk about it is very, very simple, but it misses the point. To use a prop actually shows very, very simple. Often when we introduce meditation, we describe it as we put our attention on the object, such as the breath, such as our loving kindness, or a feeling, or a mantra, or an image. We put our attention on something. And that's often called, in the Pali text, vitakka vichara, applied attention, sustained attention. But at the same time, we hear that we should let go, we should relax more. So we have these two things working together. And so I have my little prop here. And it's basically that we make contact, we have applied thought, applied attention, and we sustain it there. But then we think, oh, it's time to let go. And it falls off. And our mind rushes off into thoughts, feelings, emotions, worries, concerns, all this kind of thing. And so, what does the instruction say? When your mind loses focus, you put it back again. And then we go, okay, it's back again, paying attention to the breath, now I can let go. And down it goes again. And it goes on and on and on. Make sure I find it or I don't lose it. And the problem is, many people spend their entire meditation time basically putting it back, falls off, 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 over and over and over and over and over. And this has this is not necessarily a bad thing, because if you do it with great sincerity, it's going to teach you a lot of patience. It's going to teach you a lot of humility. And it can teach you great understanding of the mind, that it comes and goes without asking us. It just does its own thing. And if you've really got right intention and right view on this, it can be valuable. But unfortunately, many people, they're just too busy. They just don't really have the impetus to really commit to those things. And so the disadvantage they face is they get frustrated, they get disappointed because they're just doing over and over and over and it just falls off and it just doesn't work. And it's just, unfortunately, it's endless. Or worse, people can sort of think, well, this is my experience. It's not really matching up to what I find in the early Buddhist texts and the commentaries. Therefore, those things are wrong. And this is the interpretation and this is the mindfulness and this is what it's supposed to be. Now, the texts actually explain how to resolve this situation. And what do you do when you want something to stay in place? It's quite simple. Use tools. So I have some good sticky tape here. Sticks to the back of the bowl. And to make doubly sure, I've got some blue tack as well. Paste to make sure. Voila. It stays. What is the glue here? What is the sticky tape, the adhesive? What is it that makes this possible? Because this is not magic. In the Pali text, it's called Piti Sukha. Piti meaning pleasure, bliss. It's this kind of this pleasant sensation in the body, which is really reflected in the mind. And sukha, the happiness. You develop this peace, this happiness, this joy in your meditation. And that keeps the mind with the object because we're no longer fighting it. We're no longer trying to get away from it. We're no longer trying to control it because, unfortunately, we also have the problem. I'm going to use this one because that's already up there. Is people go, they fiercely try and control the breath or their meditation and they press hard and they hold it hard and tighter and tighter and tighter, really trying to hold on to the breath. And it's exhausting and it's fatiguing. And they sort of say, oh, thank goodness I can let go. Ah! Didn't work! And this is a problem so many of us face. The Piti Sukha, the pleasure and the happiness, so important to develop. In the Pali text as well, and elsewhere, where it says again and again and again, these Pali words, Pasada Kayasa, Sukhino Chittang Samadhiati. Now, if you've listened to some of the Wednesday night talks that Ajahn Brahm does, Sukhino Chittang Samadhiati would be quite familiar to you. This is one of his favorite phrases. He uses it again and again and again. The first bit, Pasada Kayasa, means with the calming of the body. Basically, we relax it. We make it more peaceful. And it becomes more pleasant to be in. And it almost feels like this buzz, this kind of happiness that grows. And that makes the mind happy. Sukhino Chittang Samadhiati. The happy mind becomes still. It enters Samadhi, which is the meditation. And this brings in the four right efforts. So we have different parts of the practice all coming together here. Four right efforts are to abandon what should be abandoned and to prevent these unwanted things from arising and to develop what should be developed, positive things. And to encourage and grow the ones that are already in your mind and in your life. And these things come together. So, this is it. This is how to develop the meditation, is by really bringing in the happiness, bringing in the enjoyment and relaxing and letting it go. Because when you let it go, as you can see, no hands, it stays. Because the mind doesn't want to go anywhere else. It's perfectly happy to be here. In fact, it's so happy to be here, the more and more, and the richer this gets, it just forgets about the outside world completely. It just has no interest in it. And the mind becomes more happy, more brighter, because all this tiresome stuff fades away. It's like we've turned the lights up, we've turned the volume up, we've enriched, sort of saturated the color and everything else, and it's become clearer. And, at the same time, the mind becomes more clear itself. So these things called the five hindrances start to disappear. And those five hindrances, simply put, is wanting things or wanting things to go away. So that's two of them. Then there's the anxiety and regrets, sometimes called restlessness and remorse. Then there's the, sort of fatigue and tiredness and laziness, sometimes called sloth and torpor. And the last one is sort of doubt, sort of, what is this? What am I really doing? And that goes round and round and round and round and round. So the mind becomes more calmer. And it doesn't need anything. It just does itself. And this is something Ajahn Brahm says, but it also some in the early Buddhist texts. It takes care of itself. We don't need to control so much. Because the problem is, more often than not, we're trying too hard on our meditation. We're afraid that it's all going to fall on us. Or we just spend our time doing our best, paying attention to our breathing and everything else. And a few seconds later, it just falls off and runs off into thoughts and feelings and other things. And it never really gets anywhere. It's still there. It's pretty simple. But I have to take it off so I don't just damage the building. So on that point, the meditation method is quite simple. But many people struggle with it because they can't relax the body. Their mindfulness isn't there. And they're not sitting very comfortably. Or they're sitting too comfortably, so they just fall asleep. It's very different. You have to find a balance there so it feels comfortable and settled. And then you allow the relaxation to occur, but you also encourage it and settle. And it becomes brighter. It feels like there's this pleasure to be to do this. And that's in a way, it's a bit of a lure to do it, which the Buddha was also a bit aware of. And he sort of says, you know, people who are addicted to doing exactly this can expect, you know, excellent results because it's useful in the meditation practice. Because once we develop the meditation and get that stillness, we get this clarity of mind. In the early Buddhist texts, this is samatha and vipassana. And in the early Buddhist texts, they're joined together as one concept, samatha vipassana. They're not actually split off. So because the meaning of vipassana means to see clearly, nowadays it's sort of referred to as sort of insight meditation, like some technique or method. And, you know, they have value, for sure. But it doesn't really make sense that we've sort of taken one without the factor that clarifies the mind. You know, it's like if we have a pair of spectacles, you know, reading glasses, which I also have a pair of prop here, and imagine they're covered with mud and dust and everything else. Even if you put them on, and you won't be able to see through them. You need to clean the glasses to be able to see through them. And so, I already want to meditate. Let's go for it. I'm a few minutes early. So shall we dive in?
Sounds absolutely wonderful.
Excellent. A few minutes short. So, first thing, everybody, stand up if you wish. Give yourself a bit of a wiggle. Loosen up. Give yourself a nice stretch. And adjust your clothing if you need to, if anything's too tight or uncomfortable, or if you need to put on a blanket or anything, because it's quite chilly in Perth. Or the opposite, if you're in the Northern Hemisphere and you're baking in the summer. Let's settle in. And of course, in this meditation, hopefully we can bring in some of these elements that we've been talking about. So, when you're ready, you can close your eyes. And the first thing we're going to do is dedicate some time to this body, to relaxing, to making ourselves more comfy. Not too comfy that we fall asleep, but more relaxed. So we don't need to do anything. We don't need to hold the body still because it's happy to be still. It'll take a few minutes just doing this. Because as we relax, the joints and the limbs sag or open up, they change shape. And so as we relax more, we need to adjust a little more. How do we feel in relationship to this? Is this something that we like to do? Where you're safe at home, or wherever you are, now's the time that we can just settle. Now we're going to use our breathing to further relax and settle the body. So when we breathe in, imagine it as an opening, as if there's an expansion. And with that expansion, a loosening, not a constriction. As if the tightness can fade away. And as we breathe out, we can settle more into the chair, sinking just softly into it. And as we breathe in and out, add some happiness to it. The happiness might already be there, and so you can encourage it more. Otherwise, you can bring it in. Just a happiness of how pleasant it is to relax and settle. Keep checking the body for any hidden tension, deeper tension than may be in your stomach or the muscles or any part of your body that's tired. And just spend some time with that, developing a good relationship with it. Try to listen to the feedback. What messages are your body sending you? What areas are calling out for a little loving kindness? Really use this time with the breathing to be 100% with yourself in this moment. The outside world can just be the outside world. Try to introduce a state, or encourage it if it's already there, of just happy to be here. you can, to be happier to be here. More relaxed, but more happy. Enjoy this. It's important for this not to be a one-sided show, but for the body and the mind to work together and to enjoy this together. And so share the happiness completely inside. attention deeper inwards, because there may still be inattention, smaller areas that really need a bit of attention, a bit of loving kindness, a bit of happiness. This is such a wonderful gift to give to yourself. More relaxed, but let the mind become brighter. Become more aware of this piti sukha, this happiness and delight in the meditation itself, just by being here. imagine a spaciousness, an openness. And fill it with kindness. With the knowledge of this opportunity that it's all right to be happy. It's all right to enjoy this. It's all right just to be here. This is the time to soften the firewalls inside of us. Spaciousness to expand and to include those nearest and dearest to you, that they may be happy too, that they too may have an enriched quality life. Now let it expand further, as far as possible, to include everyone. And now bring your attention back inside. And spend these last few minutes revisiting that happiness inside of you. And that relaxation inside of you too. Bell to bring the meditation to a close. Welcome back. When you're ready, you may open your eyes.
All right, Venerable, what would you like to do? Would you like to continue with the Dharma talk, or would you like to take some questions? How do you feel?
Oh, questions. Always.
Okay, well, good then. I visited a temple on Sunday, Venerable, and the people spoke there of unity through diversity. Mm-hmm. Would you like to talk about this a little bit for us this evening? Because sometimes it's difficult to accept diversity. Mm. It's really quite hard, and it means that we have to actually get out of our own comfort zone in order to accept something that's quite different for us. So I was wondering whether you would like to talk about how we can arm our toolbox up so that we can actually do this and open our minds to doing this and open our minds to love and kindness and metta towards all people. Mm.
Actually, this is closely related to what we were talking about before the meditation. Inside of us, there are these significant parts of the mind that want to shut out diversity. It's too much. There is a lot of it. This world is full of change and chaos and differences. And we're educated as well to have prejudices and biases, as well as our own direct experience that this is unpleasant. I want this to go away. This is pleasant, I want more of it. All these different things, thousands of different thoughts, feelings, ideas, diversity, experiences, senses. It goes on and on and on, as well as people and cultures and different philosophies. Very confusing. And so that part of the mind says, we can't deal with this, we'll shut it out. And that's a big problem. Because it's an insurmountable barrier as long as that is there, because it's a self-defense mechanism, it's a coping strategy. It's very useful, it's very important to have these until we could say skilled enough that we don't need them anymore. But while we still need them, these functions of the mind and the body are going to be active. They're going to be doing that. So an important point is to recognize that that is the case. This is basic psychology, and people can experience this for themselves. And having softness towards that, and recognizing that this resistance is not the enemy. A lot of the time it's misplaced. You know, the classic metaphor is, you know, you hear a rustle in the leaves and, you know, is it a little mouse or a little lizard that's harmless, or is it this big tiger predator that's coming to get you? Very evolutionary psychology as well. So we need to have that softness for the experience within to begin with. Because where we fall into a big trap is trying to embrace diversity while still that resistance is there. And then we're just endlessly trying to be incorporating more and more and more, and yet it's still, there's inner part of it saying, you're not listening to me. You know, I'm here, I need help. We can't manage this, and you're putting more fuel on the fire. So it needs a slow start. To build a good relationship with ourselves, to recognize that those coping mechanisms, those fears, those concerns are there, those anxieties are there, and we deal with those directly. And of course, not by trying to push them away, not by trying to reject them or saying, oh, I shouldn't have these things, or, you know, go away, you're too much of a headache. They need to be brought in. They need to be included in this picture. Because when we get to this bigger concept of unity, it's recognizing, in Buddhist language, what the five khandhas are. That basically is commonly translated as five aggregates. Basically, we're all solids, liquids, gases, and energy. You know, it's a fundamental basis of the universe. On that level, there's really no difference between us. The rest of the khandhas, of course, are experience, vedana, the perception of the body and experience, which is sanya, as well as the ideas and everything else that go with that, the interpretation of it. Then, sankharas, the desires, the will, the interaction to it, the push-pull, I want this, I don't want that, the constructions, the formations, huge section of the mind, the sankharas. And then finally, the six types of consciousness, the sense consciousness and the mind consciousness. And all that works together, they're all functions, and everybody has it. So on that level, there's unity there as well. We're all in the same boat, so to speak, even though we are so different. Because, I mentioned before, the soup pot, just a tiny little ingredient, a little pinch of salt or a pinch of chili or something else, will change the entire soup. And so a different belief, a different culture, a different environment will change that person entirely, even though it's still essentially a pot of soup. But the bigger picture is we can embrace that. But it only starts from inside to be open out. So this is, again, a very, very big subject, and I've really only scratched the surface of it. But I hope that helps. Does it sort of nudge towards what you're feeling?
I'm busy writing away here furiously.
Okay.
Thank you very, very much. Yes, it does help. It helps a lot.
No worries.
Thank you so much. Now, we have Alyssa has left a message here in the chat. She says she's sorry she's unable to talk with you directly, and she would ask you to speak about coming back to the breath, not just sitting in meditation, but like the discourse on loving kindness says, while standing, walking, seated, or lying down. And finally, she says, I hope it makes sense.
That bit sort of, I hope it makes sense, that's usually the line I put out. But very, very interesting question, actually, because this standing, sitting, lying, walking, lying down, walking, and all the rest of it, basically, they're all the postures that we operate in life. Really, they're just sort of variations on those same four. So being aware of the breathing in nose is basically being aware of it throughout daily life, which is not so easy, because if we're busy working, obviously our attention needs to be put on what needs to be attention. If there's an emergency going on, well, don't focus on your breathing, you need to act. You know, if your young child is about to put their hand in, you know, a stove flame or something, then forget about your breathing, pay attention to that. There's priorities. When we look at the Satipatthana Sutta, which lists all these different forms of meditation, mindfulness, I should say, what's really interesting is the vast majority of them are things that we do with our eyes open. We often think they're things that we have to do when we're sitting down in meditation. And to an extent, they apply there too, to settle, as we did at the beginning. But the vast majority of these things are in our daily life. And so, we need to be able to relax in those postures in our daily life to be able to do that. I mentioned before, you know, people who are trying desperately to hold on to things. You know, when I held up the tape against the wall kind of thing. And it's exhausting to do that, to try and be mindful of the breath in every moment, as well as everything else that we have to do. It's fatiguing, it's exhausting, and we can't do it. There's this resistance coming up, resentment coming up, inner problems. And so eventually we just let go. And of course, you know, the giveaway that there's a problem going on is that it feels so much better when we stop doing it. That's really quite a revealing sign of what's really going on. And so bringing in the breath into those things gives an opportunity to not only be aware in our daily life, but also to use the breath to relax in our daily life. So if we're hectic, dealing with dozens of customers and it's busy, 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 pressures, deadlines, you can sneak out and have a little toilet break or just go outside and just breathe and relax. And that brings a bit more energy back and a bit more time. But there's a danger is that we will use that to enable us to, unfortunately, take on more pressure, take on more stress. And unfortunately, we're using this the wrong way. And we will end up taking on more because we think we can cope with it. Or, unfortunately, our bosses think that we can cope with it. And we end up burning out. So we do have to be careful with that one. Usually these things are designed for when we're in a meditation context, a retreat context, or at home when we don't have all these pressures. So after we finish doing all our jobs and chores, we have some quiet time. That's really when it's useful. So hope that helps.
I'm sure it does, Venerable. Tony has his hand up. Tony, would you like to unmute and speak to Venerable, please?
Mm-hmm. Chris, thank you, Arjun. That was wonderful. Arjun, I wondered if you could talk a bit about meditating on the Buddha. Mm-hmm. I'm not familiar with what that really is all about.
Yep, no problem. The gist of it is connected with this form of meditation called Buddha Nusati, which is a recollection of the Buddha. And this came in great fame in later Buddhism, particularly in Mahayana and Vajrayana. This form of meditating on Buddhas is becomes very, very famous. But the gist of it is as used as a mantra to settle the mind, but also because that word has meaning. And in the cultures which come up with the word Buddha, which is particularly Thailand, they have reverence for that word. And so they're incorporating reverence into what they're doing, as well as inspiration. The fact that it's with an O ending instead of an A ending is a bit of a Thai interpretation of Pali. In sort of in nominal case, to get grammatical, they often put an O ending in Pali. So Ajahn Brahm's name in Pali is Brahmawamso. It has an O ending. And a lot of the names have an O ending. Whereas in Pali itself, they don't. So it's a bit strange. So that's why you don't find characters like Sariputto instead of Sariputta. It's just an interpretation. So you could use the word Buddha, no problem. So there are elements connected with it of reverence, of respect, but also this feeling of Buddha inside of you, so to speak. We can call it Buddha nature to bring a more commonly known idea, is that it uplifts you. Problem with mantras, though, is that they can become quite controlling. So you breathe in Buddha, Buddha, and it becomes quite sort of tight. So it's more sort of something to calm down. If you find a mantra makes you tight, then you have full permission to stop using it, because it's not really what it's for. So I hope that helps.
And also on the previous topic, we have a comment in the chat, and this has come from Gita. And she says, perhaps it's also that until we overcome self-notion, diversity will always remain a threat.
Also true. Also very correct. In the three, what are called the three fetters of Buddhism, this is getting into much deeper stuff, there's one of these fetters called Sakkaya Ditti, which basically means identity view. All the different forms of identity and things that we usually put pronouns on. So it's usually put in Buddhism as a me, mine, what I am. But it also is first person, second person, and plural. So it's not just what, it's me, it's you, it's them, it's us, it's ours, all these terminologies. If we're still relating to the world in that way, absolutely there will be diversity. Unfortunately, it's just how we navigate the world. And it's because we haven't really seen through that, we've taken it too literally, that instead of being a convenience, we take it as reality.
Thank you, Venerable. Is there anybody else? Oh, yes, Yondi, would you like to speak? How lovely. Welcome.
A question about the pain sensation during the meditation.
Mm-hmm.
Like traditionally, we tell ourselves that we watch the sensation, we don't attach to it. But earlier on, when we were doing the meditation, I was experiencing quite an obvious pain of higher intensity in my knee,
mm-hmm.
and it just distracted me. I find it a bit, or rather, I find it really hard to kind of relax and feel happy in the moment. Yeah, so I wonder whether you could give me some guidance on.
Sure. Do you have an injury in that part? Do you have any knee injuries?
It's more like an osteoarthritis sort of condition.
Okay, right. A lot of times when the mind starts to relax, it diverts energy to your knees as a kind of a healing context. But unfortunately, it does make it more painful. But basically, it's often a positive thing. Unfortunately, though, it can be very, very distracting. But you can kind of tell whether it's a healing strategy that the body is taking full advantage of, or whether it's kind of sending you a message that the posture is not ideal, in which case you have full liberty to change the posture.
I did.
This is it. But if it still remains, even when you change the posture, and it's still there, then it does usually have a different context. And it's usually something that you have to spend more time with to really find out. Because a lot of the time it could be sort of, ow, 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 I really hurt, but you've not been listening to me all the time, and you've been sort of stomping around and living life, not really taking care of me as the knee joint. And so it's sort of bringing your attention to the situation. The most important thing, of course, is how you reacted to it, how you responded to it. Because if you can completely allow it to be there, it does many, many times fade away on its own because it can relax. It can feel that it's been acknowledged and it's been included and it can relax more. But if there's any resistance or disappointment, it's like, oh, why is this pain here? I want it to go away. I should be relaxing and enjoying this. We ironically and tragically reinforce it, make it stronger, because it's trying to get our attention more and we're just pushing it away more. So the more resistance, kind of equal opposite forces kind of thing happening. But it's something that does need a lot of time with.
Thank you.
No worries.
Oh, Gloria, welcome. Please go ahead, Gloria. That would be lovely. Welcome.
I have a question that's based on what Chris just asked. Sometimes I think the difficulty in embracing diversity is that I cannot understand. I simply cannot understand the person. So I have a person which has done something I think is really bad to a person that I love very much. And I have a very hard time to forgive her because I simply cannot understand why she did that. Because she did something bad, then I will assume that she has a bad intention. And then once I came to a conclusion that she has a bad intention in doing this, I have a very hard time to really let it go because I would just keep thinking about why did she do something like that. So I have a lot of resentment and also anger. So how to deal with such a situation? Thank you.
No problem. It sometimes is useful to understand the other person as well. I've dealt with a number of cases which have required to look back in previous generations of that family because sometimes there are abuses, social conditionings, how parents bring up their children. They're fully conditioned. They're brought up sometimes to be self-centered and nasty. This is what's called in Buddhism as the defilements, greed, hatred and delusion. And they're a major part of the mind. They're basically running riot. And a lot of the time, they just come into the mind big saying, I want to do this and be nasty or whatever. And it just does it. It pretty much runs over us with a steam train kind of thing. So it does often help to understand the other person. But at the same time, to understand our own resentment and to understand our own feelings. Because while we have that resentment to the other person, and that we continue to find importance in that resentment, it will remain there. And it will only get worse the more you interact or see that person, or see triggers of that person. So this person you love might talk again about that situation that was painful to them, and straight away it arises. This is something that takes a while to deal with, but it's very rewarding to deal with, because it's very liberating. So with this person, it's important to try and understand where they're coming from. There are, of course, times where, you know, they just got out the wrong side of the bed that morning and just had a rough, you know, they got late in work and just problems and problems, and they couldn't handle their situation and were just nasty. But deep down, they're actually a good person. But sometimes they're just conditioned that way. That's the way they know how to act in the world. And therefore, you feel more compassion for them because they have to live with that situation. They've poisoned their own mind as much as they've hurt someone else. It does take a lot of inner strength to be able to do that, because there's a lot of people out there who have been very, very badly abused and traumatized. And to try and bring this kind of subject in, and sort of say to this person who's freshly abused from all kinds of atrocity and say, oh, forgive, 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 that's not going to work. We need to take this inward time with our own pain and try and make our peace with it. You know, Ajahn Brahm often sort of says, open the door of your heart to it. And it's a very, very good way of doing it. The classic, according to early Buddhism, approach to dealing with anger and resentment is loving kindness. But if that resentment overpowers the loving kindness, then there's a bit of a power struggle. And the more time you spend with metta in a positive context, such as metta to that person that you love or to yourself, and let it grow stronger. And, you know, don't apply it to the person who hurt you or that you're angry with at the moment. But until it's really strong inside yourself, and then give them a little bit, then a little bit more, then a little bit more, until you can express it more freely. But it does help to really understand where that person is coming from, because they may just be conditioned that way. And then they have to live with that for their entire lives, and all the people around them have to live with it too. Very difficult at times. So again, it's a big subject, it does take a lot of time, but start slowly. And it's okay to be upset. And I hope that helps.
Yes, thank you very much.
And thank you too for your question, Gloria. Is there anyone else who would like to speak? Mute and speak. It's I'm getting some very nice questions this evening.
I'd like to ask a question.
Of course.
For Melanie. Yes, you're great.
Thank you, Venerable. It was very interesting. Recently, I found that a lot of people around me are very, well, not very depressed, but feeling depressed and negative feelings,
mm-hmm.
even though they're not, there is nothing, how do I say that? For instance, sometimes I feel not happy and a bit sad, but nothing without any reason. And I found that people around me are feeling the same, maybe because of the bad news or whatever. And I found what you said very interesting about trying to put joy in the meditation. But I was wondering if it's better when I feel like that. Is it better to see that I feel sadness inside, or is it better to try to bring joy? I mean, I'm not sure I'm very clear about that. Because sometimes I think that if I don't recognize my sadness, well, the sadness inside, it's a bit like trying to push it out, to push it away.
Mm.
Or should I stay a bit with it and try to embrace it, to open the door of my heart, maybe to this sadness? Or is it better to look at the things around and to try to feel gratitude? So I'd like to have your advice about that. Thank you.
No worries. This one is also a good question, because it's more subtle. It's exactly right in many ways, is that it does need to be brought in. Recognizing the sadness, the upset, the disappointments, all these things need to be recognized and they need to be included so not sort of shut out. Because it's like a small child being shut outside the house. It just gets worse and, you know, it destroys it. But, so there's a danger that we could be trying to bring joy in to kind of push the resentment out and the disappointment out and the sadness and the depression out. And of course, that's where it backfires. So they really need to work together there. It's a bit of both. So it's bringing it in, but at the same time, having kindness for it. And at the same time, having joy that you can do this. Because if we have too much sadness, we become more depressed. We become morbid, more drained, and just goes on and on and on. And it's very, very difficult that way. So it is a bit of both. But with all the people around as well, sometimes they need a bright, happy person around them to lift them up. But sometimes they don't. Sometimes they are trapped in their own sadness and they don't want to see somebody happy because that makes them resentful. It is being sensitive to the moment. What do we really need right now? And being sensitive to that. And in responding appropriately. So certainly, bring the sadness in. It needs to be brought in. It needs to be acknowledged. It needs to be recognized. It needs to be included. But at the same time, recognize that we can't drown in this, because there is an awful lot of bad news in the world. And the thing is, the more and more bad news and the more depressed and sad we get, the less able we are not only to live our own lives, but the less able we are to fix the problem or to help or to do what needs to be done. So it's definitely about bringing inner strength, lifting yourself up,
recognizing you do have these tools, you do have the strength. The joy is there. Use it. Does this help? Does it make sense?
Yeah. Thank you.
Yeah. No problem.
Well, it looks like you're making a lot of sense this evening, Venerable. Thank you. There's a message from Jennifer that I didn't read out before, Venerable. She says, Sadhu, a beautiful intro talk and guide. Big thanks for reminding us about relaxation and joy in meditation.
Thank you.
So that's from Penang. Is there anybody else who would like to make a comment or speak? Well, I think it's come to that magic moment. Venerable, would you like to offer us a blessing?
Sure. I was trying to think of one. There's so many.
I'm sure you'll think something beautiful.
Well, you know, may you find this happiness in yourself. Because it is there. And may you be able to use that in your own life to be happier and more able to live life in these dark times. So, thank you for having me.